Hello and welcome back to the Let's Backflip Show Happy Hour. I'm Ryan Fring, co-creative director here at Backflip and Lord of the Podcast. I forgot that in the last three intros. The self-titled Lord of the Podcast. And I'm just cranking these out because we've got so many back episodes we have to get out. Chilling at home on a snow day. It's kind of loud upstairs. You can kind of hear it. I'm trying to like kill the noise with a noise filter. But you can't get rid of all the children screaming. So you're going to hear a little bit of that in the background. But that's fun. That's life. So this week, we're hanging with Tom Kermgard. This is fun. He's kind of like a staple in the industry. He's one of the big producers that have been around and been at several different companies. Mirror 34. Oh, that's great. There's the doorbell. Mirror 34, as well as now Kingdom. And he talks about commercial production and having fun while still working hard. And we've talked to Tom a lot over the years, and he just has so much wisdom from the industry and the industry in our area. So he's been such a great resource and just such a nice dude to hang out with and chat. So this is a real fun one. I say that about everyone, but I only have really fun people on the show. So without further ado, this is episode 40 with Tom Kermgard. Hello and welcome back to another happy hour. I'm Ryan Fring, creative director here at Backflip. And unfortunately, John Shoemaker is not joining me today. He might be actually joining us live watching. He's traveling to do some hunting, some pheasant hunting, I believe. So we wish him the best of luck. And I can't wait to eat some of that pheasant stew that you bring back. But today, let's see if I can get this going. We've got our good buddy and friend, there we go, Tom Kermgard joining us today. Tom is an executive producer at Kingdom Filmworks, but anyone in the industry knows that type of role, you get to do a lot of different things. So he's written, he's directed, he's probably managed production, calling, for food and just all the little tasks for every part of it. So welcome, Tom, to the show.
Ryan, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here. I'm also glad to hear that John isn't here because of me, that he's actually out doing something. Yeah. I got nervous when you said John wasn't going to be here. I figured he's still mad at me for something.
Yeah, well, and we'll get into that something. I mean, I think it's an excuse that he put out there. He's like, I'm hunting. So
yeah,
I definitely can't be on with Tom.
I can't picture it. So where is he pheasant hunting, by the way?
Out in South Dakota. He has family out there. I think, was it Mission Hill area?
Got it.
We figured this out like 2 years ago. We've known each other for, I'm looking at my watch, like that can tell the years. We've known each other for maybe 17 years or 16 years or so and worked together for maybe 14 of those. But we just realized a couple of years ago that we both have extended family like in the same towns out there in South Dakota.
Nice. So it's that small world thing is, you see it over and over and over again, and it sounds cliche, but it's crazy.
Yeah. I'm glad that we're finally streaming though, because we can actually talk. I have been holding back my conversation with you. It's always a fun thing to do, but, for those who don't know you, can you just tell us a little bit, give us your introduction?
Yeah, I'm going to give an introduction, but then I want to remind me, I do want to tell a fun small world story, just kind of piggybacking on what you said. But Tom Kermgard, I've been in this crazy business, Ryan, not to date myself, but basically about 30 years. I graduated from Northern Illinois University back in 1989. And like most people at that time, there weren't a ton of production jobs. And so I went into Chicago in the Chicago suburbs, and I worked as a copywriter for 2 years because that's what everyone in production did when they got out and couldn't find a job. They went and became a copywriter in Chicago and then kind of worked their way into the production world. So, but it was great for me. It was great for me to start out as a writer. I'm a producer now and have been for the better part of 20 years, but knowing being on the creative side and understanding the creative discipline has helped me every single day of my career. Mm-hmm. Because I think it's incredibly important for a producer to be right brain and left brain. You have to be super, super organized. But if you don't understand or have a creative side to you, you're going to fail. Same thing on the creative side. Creative sides really need to, I like working with creatives that are ultra creative, but have the ability to be organized. That's, I mean, that's the sweet spot. So no one can be 100% in either direction. And so for me, being on the creative side, and then also in the agency world, I actually, I spent time on the account service side. So I understand that line that often goes between creative and account service. And I've successfully been able to manage both sides, which sometimes there's friction there, and I'm able to kind of find ways to get people to work together. So I've been a copywriter, I've been an account supervisor, but for the vast majority of my career, I've been an executive producer in the video and film industry.
I love that too. And I think that's why we've, you know, reached out to you in many occasions to get your feedback and thoughts on different situations. You know, when we find just good people in the community, we reach out to them and pick their brain. I know we've picked your brain before, because that idea of producing and the creative, like you said, they can be at odds sometime, but having a perspective that includes both, we've certainly found as well, can be so helpful, because you can be approaching a project, even pitching a project, and you know this may be way outside their budget range. So how are you actually going to pull off a similar creative within those limitations? And if you're solely just thinking about the creative, you're not thinking about how to produce a thing, you're not going to think about some of those. And John and I talk about that too. Like, you don't want to handicap yourself in the sense of knocking everything down. Like, oh, it's going to be hard to find a lab, or, oh, it's going to be hard to do this. You know, so we try to have that first creative meeting as a safe space and be like, yeah. If you think there's a lab and an airplane in it, let's start there. And then once we know we need to come back, let's move it back, you know?
Right. And I found, and I know, I guarantee you and John have found that over the years too, that sometimes what seems daunting, like finding that we need to use an airplane, or we need to shoot inside of an airport, sometimes those are not nearly as hard as you think, if you can find somebody on the inside that is enthused about what you're doing. And sometimes things that you think might be easy become real tricky. So it's never, you know, that's the challenge. And that's what I love about this industry is, you know, there's so many variables that just make it fun. I mean, a true story is about 1 month after 9/11 happened. This is no kidding. 1 month after 9/11 happened, I had a client come to me with a concept that involved shooting in an airport terminal. And I basically said that there's not a chance that that's ever going to work. Not now, not in this climate. I don't even want to go down that route. And the client was very persistent. And I checked. And I checked in with Dane County Airport, explained what we wanted to do. And the director of the airport at that time, drawing a blank on his name, but his son was in the production industry out in California. And so he was interested in what we were doing, and basically got back to me with, we can help you if you can do these five things for us, ensure me of these five things. And it worked out. It was crazy. So it just, you know, sometimes, you know, it should never be a hard no. You know, there's always ways around it. And sometimes it's good fortune. You know, it's very fortunate that I found somebody that was an evangelist for it, you know?
Yeah. Well, and like you said, just asking, you know, you never know until you ask. And that's certainly, you know, as a producer, as an executive producer, I'm sure that's a lot of what you get to do. And I think your video's frozen for me. I am hearing your audio fine, but we'll see if that fixes itself momentarily.
Likewise, you're frozen for me, but you're coming through loud and clear. So I have found that if I pause my syncing on my computer, sometimes it resolves the issue. So let's find out. But as long as we can hear each other.
a nice picture of you up there.
Put something else up, please. So hey, let me go back to that one small world story, because I know, like, you and John have, you know, been joined at the hip for a number of years, known each other a long time. And then you find out after you've worked together, a small world story. So, you know, Chris Dabner, one of our editors at, mm-hmm. at Kingdom. So Chris and I have worked together for nearly 10 years, and we worked together for about five before we found out. We did know that we grew up in the same hometown of Rockford, Illinois. But we found out after about 5 years of working together that our grandparents lived on the same street in Rockford, directly across the street from each other. And our grandmothers had coffee every Wednesday morning together for 30 years.
Oh my gosh.
So I just, you know, it's one of those things where it's just like, when, like I say, it's cliche, but the world is so small, and it's, those kind of threads are always really fun. You know, so I always enjoy when people tell me small world stories. I'm like, yeah, I believe it. Mm-hmm. We've had a lot of them.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I know, like, I grew up a military brat in a sense, like, you know, half my mm-hmm. life along the East Coast, traveling, you know, every 3 years or 4 years we'd move. Mm-hmm. So, like, I never had anything like roots. So now we actually have history and are connecting with people in a way. And we ran into somebody, you know, and this is maybe not a locational thing, but like, we're Catholic. And so like the Catholic community that, you know, larger than just one location, somebody we met here who had moved after my wife and I got married, mm-hmm. Their grandma, I think it's about the same story as yours. Their grandma like would hang out with our grandma constantly, mm-hmm. and they knew each other, you know, and that was one of the first times that I was like, oh my gosh, I love just being somewhere and connecting with people and like having a depth to a history, a shared history together.
Yeah.
And it's exactly like your story. And I love that.
Yeah.
I want to see if we can fix your video or, you know, our connection real quick. Mm-hmm. I've got a pretty good stream going over here, to Facebook. But let's see, this is part of the joy of, you know, doing live streams. Things just happen and you roll with it. And it's a teaching moment.
Right. Sure. Hey, let's and see. if you want me to leave and come back in, maybe we just need to do that.
Yeah, let's try that real quick.
All right, I'm going to leave. I'll be back within 2 minutes.
Copy
talk
that.
Talk amongst yourselves.
That's right. One thing, you know, we like to do because this is a happy hour is talk about our happy hour drinks. There's never any pressure, always encouragement. You know, we understand how people's schedules go, but today I've got some whiskey from our friends at Dancing Goat. This is their Limousine Rye, which is a real nice mixing whiskey. I also just like to drink it straight. You know, it's not bad at all. And then just as a backup, you know, we've got to be repping. We've always got to rep Carbon 4. So this is a hard seltzer when I need to hydrate. Yeah. Yeah, this, and I like that we're turning this around. You're starting to interview me.
So get ready.
Yeah, it's just a part of your nature. There we go. I got you back. Boom.
Yep.
So let's see. They opened up 5 or 6 years ago, and they're actually kind of by my house. I live by the airport. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine heard about them through the grapevine. And spoilers, Zach and Ryan, they're Catholic guys. So when they came in and they were doing this brewery, like I heard through all the channels and I was like, oh, we got to meet these guys. Mm-hmm. So we went to their opening. And another friend of mine had a party there within a few months of them opening. Mm-hmm. And we went through the tour that was there. And I basically just kind of hit it off with Ryan, the brewmaster.
Sure.
The other Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
We hit it off. And I was like, hey, this was 6 years ago, maybe. Mm-hmm. I had been in contact with a Canon sales rep. And mm-hmm. they were sharing with us a new version, maybe it was the Canon C300 or something, mm-hmm. you know, new camera at the time. And they're like, yeah, you can have it for a week and see how it goes. So I connected with Ryan and I was like, hey, I got this camera coming next week. I'd love to just screw around and shoot some stuff. Would you be open to doing that?
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically how that relationship started.
Very cool. Very cool. They do brew some great products. Fantasy Factory has long been a favorite of mine. But that's not what I have today. So my beers of choice are more specific than specific favorites. But I'm a porter guy. I love porters, and now we're at this time of year. Mm-hmm. Porters are my thing. In summer, I'm a session IPA guy. So I love Fresh Coast from Three Sheeps up in Sheboygan. Got to give those guys a shout out. And then Founders All Day IPA out of Michigan. Mm-hmm. Those are my two summer beers. Mm-hmm. And right now, I'm a big fan of a number of porters, but I think the best one, and I have one right here. I poured a half of one, Ryan, just because I wanted to be social and do the happy hour thing with you.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, is the Edmund Fitzgerald Porter out of Ohio from Great Lake Brewing. I just think it's there's a lot of great porters, a lot of great porters. I love Polka King Porter from Door County, mm-hmm. the Night Rain from Oso, and the Black Butte Porter. From Deschutes, all great, but the Edmund Fitzgerald is a cut above, and mm-hmm. that's my and this one I have in my hand is actually a gift from audio guy extraordinaire Dustin Harmon, so I got to give him a shout out.
Nice. And let's see, you said Founders before. Do you get into is it KBC and CBC, like I forget all the acronyms, but all their kind of fancier barrel aged beers that you got?
I don't, you know, I have to say my wife and I both, when we're going for our beers, we really look for things with low ABVs. Mm. So like, that's why I really like sessions. You know, the session, you know, those are usually in your low fours. A lot of porters are pretty low. When you get to, a lot of stouts are pretty low too, but then you start to get like to an Imperial stout and they start, you know, like 8, 9, 10, 12.
Right.
I don't enjoy those as much. So to answer your question on some of those specialty beers, from Founders and other breweries, I tend to find that the ABVs start to creep way up, and, I like to avoid those.
Yeah. You know, I'm kind of in the same place too, because while I like the flavor, I'd mm-hmm. like to be able to have more than one.
There you go. Yeah, that's exactly right. And I'm a lightweight. I mean, I'll admit it. I mean, that's you can ask any guys in my fraternity in college, it will tell you I was a lightweight.
Well, I feel like that's you know, just a sign of wisdom, because I feel like as I get older, like I said, like, yeah, I want lower ABV and, you know, be able to drink something a little bit longer. And
yeah, yep, exactly right. So typically I'm not having anything at my lunch hour, but I want it in the spirit of this podcast. Cheers.
Yeah, you know, it helps us creatives think. So mm-hmm. You had mentioned coming out of school and starting off more as a writer. How did we get from writer to kind of where you are now, executive producer?
Because
there's lots of paths you can go, right?
Yeah, there's a really short line to that. So I started working, like I say, as a copywriter in the Chicago suburbs, and I was a very, very cocky, just great, thought I knew everything. You know, that's a very familiar. And mm-hmm. I was working at this agency that had a lot of national accounts in the food industry. They had like Dan and Yogurt, Light and Lively Yogurt, all the brown berry breads, Thomas's English Muffins, Sierra Peter Bread. I mean, just, it was Hellman's Mayonnaise, Banquet Meat Pies. They just, tons of stuff. And I was, you know, right out of school, I'm working on writing copy for all these things. And I didn't really know how good I had it, that, you know, here I am, you know, I'm 21 years old. I'm working on these national accounts. Anyway, long and short of it, I was kind of vocal and I wanted to do more and wanted to try and use my radio, TV, film background. And I was just pestering the creative director nonstop. And I wore him down And he started letting me kind of work on some radio spots and then producing those and directing those. And he felt comfortable doing that. And then somehow, I don't exactly know how this happened, but there was some turnover and transition at the agency. And it was about a week before they were going to shoot a spot, a national TV spot for Light and Lively Yogurt. That had some animation involved with the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Oh, that's so fun.
We're doing a tie-in with that. And about a week before the shoot was to happen, they had some turnover, and then the person who was directing the spot was no longer going to direct the spot. So the owner of the agency came in, stuck his head in my office, and goes, "Hey, you're one of those TV guys, right?" And I was like, "Yeah, that's what the school for." He goes, "All right, well, you're now directing this spot." So I was 22. I had absolutely no idea what I was doing, trying to direct a spot that was involving live action plus motion graphics. And but I didn't know what I didn't know. And I just plunged ahead and got it done. And all of a sudden, I was like, well, Jesus Christ, you know, I'm hot stuff here. I'm 22, just directed a national spot, you know, boom, boom, boom. Mm-hmm. Pay me. And they said, no. So I said, all right, I'm gonna go elsewhere. So I went to another agency shortly thereafter. I didn't realize how good I had it, but I will give a shout out to Tony Marsilia, who was the owner of that agency. Mm-hmm. I look back on, you know, my time there with so much fondness, and if Tony were listening, I hope he knows how much I appreciate the opportunity and how ignorant I was to what a great opportunity he afforded me. And I, the guy was awesome. So anyway, long and short of it is I went to another agency, was in the creative department. They had an opening on the account service side, and I was kind of itching to get out of the creative, you know, that's not true. I was just itching to make more money. And this position that was open was going to pay more, and I went for it. And that's how when I say I straddled the line on the creative side and the account service mm-hmm. side, that's what happened. I had an opportunity to, I recently married, a little baby, all that kind of stuff. And I just, it was an opportunity to make more money for the family. So I did the mm-hmm. account service side for a while. Then
what was that like as a transition, from being a creative, kind of getting that start and feeling that, and then moving, and you know, moving from agency to agency just kind of seems part and parcel to the world that we live in.
Yeah,
but it's, you know, account.
It was actually
pretty different.
It was an easier transition than for me anyway than you would think on the surface. It was actually, I mean, also in retrospect and being 100% honest, I think as you get older, I'm a hell of a lot more realistic about who I am than I was back then. You know, mm-hmm. at 21, I was 100% certain I was the most creative person on the planet.
Yeah.
You know, you just think there's not a thing in the world you can't do.
Well, I think as a creative, you got to have a little bit of that ego, you know, somebody
you
needs
do.
To see my vision. And
yeah, you
hopefully
absolutely
you can balance
do.
That with I don't know what you balance that with.
As I started to, you know, being a little more reflective and honest with myself, I realized that pretty much everyone I was working with in the creative departments were a lot more creative than I was, and that I really started to feel my strengths were definitely in logistics and organization. Okay. And I decided that I should really kind of go in the direction where I thought my strengths were. And so that account service thing played into my strengths. And then fortunately, that was the road back into production, which is really what I wanted to do all along. You know, I really wanted to be in production and I wanted to be a producer. And that's a hard role to land in, like right out of school. You got to get some experience. You got to get some chops. You got to meet some people. Coming out of school, I mean, I had all of the production classes, but I was not an editor. I was not an audio op. I was not a shooter. Right. I had skills in those areas, but my skill set was definitely on the producing side, bringing it all together. And so And that's basically what I've done then for the past 20 years.
Well, I think you point out something very interesting too, and I want to get your take on that is, you know, what are the qualities that you need to have as a producer? You know, we've learned a lot over the years, and it's been interesting because we've worked with various producers, and, you know, to some extent at the end of the day, we're executive producers or, you know, the owners to mm-hmm. some degree, because there's always those couple of things. There's relationships, there's understanding business and kind of mm-hmm. management, and then managing the creatives. You know, those might be some of the three biggest things. Maybe that's more executive producer than it is producer, but
yeah,
you certainly need some experience in order to understand that.
Yeah. I think the key things for a producer, you know, number one is you have to be like super organized, just hyper organized, you know, beyond organized. You have to be able to cross every T and dot every I. And you have to be a good time manager. You have to have the skills to be able to like, okay, I'm hearing about this project here and it's needed there. And almost instantly you've got to be able to in your mind just split up that time and know how it's going to get done. I mean, you have to be able to spin a lot of plates. You know, as an editor or a shooter, you have the luxury at times of being able to kind of focus on, hey, I know I have this one project in my edit suite this week and I can put my head down and get it done. A producer is touching every project that's going through the shop and you're spinning a lot of plates. But I think that like the number one producer has to have to be successful is foresight. You have to have the foresight to see what one contingency plan. You need to have, you know, plan A's, A, B, and C, and then be ready when those three somehow don't work, because things can and do go wrong. That's a reality about production, but it's how you react to those in the moment that make the difference. And there's just a lot of variables, you know, for a producer. I mean, everything from people getting sick, especially, you know, like in the time of COVID now, you know, yeah, crews right. change it up. Weather. I mean, we're in Wisconsin. We're doing production in Wisconsin. The weather is a reality. It's, you know, so it's planning for those kinds of things. So those for me are the things a producer has to have. You have to be able to think on your feet. You have to have foresight. You've got to be organized. Mm-hmm. You also have to be a team builder. You know, at the end of the day, you've got to put together crews. We have 8 people on our team at Kingdom, full-time people at mm-hmm. Kingdom. But we probably have a roster of 30 freelancers, you know, much like you guys, you know, that you tap mm-hmm. into. And we've got our preferred freelancers and that we use on a regular basis. We need to be a place where they work. So it's about, you know, keeping things lively and having projects that people know are going to run on time, and being honest about, hey, a shoot day that might run long, giving people, you know, heads up about that, providing adequate lodging and meals. You know, we try to be really easy to work with, but we try to be, you know, beyond that, we try to be like super professional. Like if someone's going to do something with mm-hmm. us, They know that it's not Mickey Mouse time. Mm-hmm. And we take a lot of pride in that. I do take a lot of pride in that.
And something you said there too makes me kind of more curious as well, in between, you know, account services and then producing and then now more executive producing in the Midwest here, you know, crews and projects, and actually, you know, probably across the country and world, people are wearing more and more hats out of necessity. And so the distinction between an account services person and a producer, or a producer and an executive producer out here, you know, often those lines are very blurred, or that one person does mm-hmm. all three of those things. So what was that like for you to go from account services, which seems more of you're on the client side, you know, working with them, and checking back in with the creative or the agency side, to being a producer where you're kind of doing a little bit of both of those things?
Yeah, you know, I'm very fortunate. Like I think in the executive producer role, I have so much client contact that I think all the years that I spent in account service helped me out every day. It really does. But you're right though about lines getting blurred. I always stress to our producers that part of our job on shoot day is we're the first one to arrive, we're the last one to leave. And when we're shooting that's when we're shooting on location. And when we're shooting on location, we have the responsibility of making sure that wherever we are at, we leave it in better shape than when we got there. You know, doing walkthroughs, mm-hmm. making sure that the homeowners that we're dealing with, or business owners are happy that, like, okay, you left this place in great shape. You know, that's part of our reputation. So as the executive producer, I do not like showing up to a set late, leaving early, or I even having done this for as long as I've done it, you know, I will still fill coolers and carry coolers and mm-hmm. throw out the garbage and load the back of my truck up with garbage bags that throw out of the dumpster back of the studio, because I will even like I say, you know, my age and years of experience, I will do every single role right alongside everyone on my crew because I feel it's the right thing to do. And mm-hmm. it just so the line, and it's okay here in Wisconsin. If I were out on either coast, I think there would be people like, dude, you're the executive producer, you shouldn't be filling a cooler, you're sending the wrong message, or we got mm-hmm. people for that. You know, we don't have 40 person crews, we have 12 person crews. I'm happy to do it, and I actually, you know, frankly, I take pride in it, and I think it helps build a little loyalty with my team members and my extended team members and our freelance folks. So, but to answer your question, I do want to stress that the years in account service have just paid dividends in the executive producer role for me in terms of the way dealing with clients on the account service side and dealing with clients from an executive producer role, those skill sets are they dovetail and I've learned over the years, as a lot of people have, when I was young in my career, it was like the question wasn't even out of a client's mouth and I was already, yep, we can do it, we can absolutely whatever, I didn't even hear budget, right, date, logistics, anything. It was like yeah we can do it. And it took me a while to understand that sometimes saying yes is detrimental to your client. That, mm-hmm. It took me a while to kind of understand that I'm doing my client a disservice if I don't really weigh everything they just told me and come back to them with, hey, I hear what you're saying and I know what you're saying, but this. And I'm just, I'm just very comfortable having those kind of conversations now. And that just comes with experience and age and confidence in just looking at something and seeing a 10 red flags 100 miles. And so account service producer, executive producer, you have to have those skills in all three of those roles.
Mm-hmm. And that, oops, there we go. That makes me think too, kind of the things that you said you're doing now as an executive producer, taking out the trash and, loading up water bottles and things like that. I think what's at the core of kind of being a filmmaker, and tell me if this resonates with you, is that entrepreneurial spirit. So, I own Backflip. I have two other partners. But when people ask what you do, I'm kind of a little hesitant because I'm like, well, I'm a creative director here, but I also, helped build the psych. And I mean, now I haven't cleaned in maybe a year or two, but I was like, I used to clean the office, I'm a janitor. Yeah. I'm constantly restocking food, restocking bathrooms, all those things, kind of taking care of, hopefully taking care of everyone around the office.
Yeah.
And I love that is like the filmmaker spirit as well, mm-hmm. is like kind of entrepreneurial, top to bottom, no BS.
And I feel need to give a shout out to I don't know if you know Mike Krefsky and Kurt Hank, but
I'm aware of Mike. Yes, I've never met him, I don't think, but I've heard his name.
Oh, well, we'll change it. I think you'd really enjoy meeting Mike. But the thing I want to point out about Mike and the other owners of Shine, and I specifically am singling out Mike because Kingdom Filmworks is really the brainchild of Mike Kreske. Mm. Okay. You know, he's the one that had this idea to put this together and has seen it grow from what it was to what it is now. And every day I'm impressed and inspired by the fact that Mike Kreske and the other owners at Shine, but I'm again singling out Mike because he's the one that's most involved with Kingdom. He carries as much water uphill as anybody on my staff. Hmm. He's the director of it all. He does everything that everyone else does, and that inspires me. And that, I mean, he works more hours than anybody. I mean, that fires me up. Mm-hmm. That when I see the people that I'm, you know, reporting to, working as hard or harder than I am, that lights a fire under me and keeps me working. And that, you know, when I see Mike not being afraid to throw a bag of garbage in the back of his truck after a shoot, you know, I'm like, it's good enough for him. It's good enough for me. So long and short of it is, mm-hmm. I think that leading by example, carrying that water uphill, it's a badge of honor for me. I like working with people that work like that. I like working like that. And, you know, I like when people around me work like that. So for what it's worth,
well,
I just wanted to give that shout out.
Yeah. And let's see. Was it Sean Riley? It says, Tom, sounding good. Thanks. Thanks, Sean.
All right. Riley is, the Facebook share must work. Now, Sean Riley, entrepreneurial spirit. Sean Riley owns his own ad agency called Twine down in the Chicago suburbs.
Oh, nice.
And Sean is a fraternity brother of mine and was actually on the golf team at Northern Illinois University. So if you ever need a ringer in a foursome, Sean Riley is your man.
Nice. That's perfect. And, well, that's that yeah. community. I love that. You know, I love that. And I love that agency community. And like, we haven't had Andy Wahlberg of KW2 on here, but like, he's one of those guys who I remember his stories, like this agency, that agency. Mm-hmm. And then we talk to like Lindsay Stone and Briggs, you know, mm-hmm. everyone involved there. And like, it's like, yep. And then they left and it's just like, a love of like sharing creative. And I love that. You know, I hope that's not just unique in the Midwest. I like to think mm-hmm. that's similar elsewhere, but I love
it. It might be unique in the Midwest.
Yeah. Well, let's lean into it.
Definitely.
So one thing you mentioned earlier that I didn't follow up with because we weren't streaming yet, but I'm super fascinated by. We'll get a little nerdy here for a second, is equipment.
Please.
You guys mentioned, you mentioned that you just got the Alexa Mini LF and have shot a little bit on it. I'm definitely, I've got a friend, John Klein down in the Chicagoland area who mm-hmm. got one as well. I can't wait to shoot with him. There's kind of two sides to my mind, and this question will come to you as an executive producer, of the importance of a tool mm-hmm. you know, versus branding versus client need,
right?
You know, on set all the time, any big commercial set, we'll have a big old camera. We own some Blackmagic cameras and people are like, oh, is that a Red? We're like, no, it's a Blackmagic. But there's something, you know, to that branding. And I'm like, hey, yeah. if you had more budget, we could have some of that equipment, you know, as a filmmaker, as a cinematographer and, you know, kind of a visual director, I really desire too. Like, I'm like, give me more pixels, give me more Ks. We can do more with that. But it's always got to be at the service of the client. So, you know, you guys got a tool that has an amazing image, just does so much. Like, tell me a little bit about that balance. Cause you know, to some degree, you have to sell that to a client as well.
Yeah. I think there's a delicate balance. You know, I think in our business, anytime you invest in technology, you have to be 100% certain it's the right thing because it's not cheap and technology changes. And there's a lot of fast followers and, you know, the next great thing is right around the corner. So the fact, Kreske and Jack Whaley, put a lot of time and effort into research and kind of, what the next, you know, what we need next. And, you know, we've got two Sony FS7s, we've got a Red, we wanted to kind of plus it a little bit. And frankly, we have some productions, some of our broadcast productions, kind of called for it. I mean, we found ourselves actually, mm-hmm. even with all of the camera gear we had, we found ourselves renting things for specific needs. And then it became, we should invest in that technology and have it house, mm-hmm. and right. become super proficient with it. So we have a guy that's really instrumental at Kingdom in charge of the tech. His name is Robert Lassiter. And Robert, between Mike Krevsky, Jack, and Robert, the decision was made to go and get the Aerie, and the Mini LF has been great. So we got mm-hmm. it, and then what happened? COVID hit, right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't a great time to get out and do production. So we got it, and the camera kind of sat, and we weren't using it. Mm-hmm. Well, but that's not 100% true, because Mike Hallskill and Jack went out and did a bunch of test shooting with it. And then Chris Debner and Kyle Stoffel were able to do a lot of work in terms of workflow and working with the footage. And, you know, the latitude you get with what comes out of that camera in terms of what Chris Debner can do in the color suite and his DaVinci suite with what's out of that camera is staggering. It's just beautiful. So anyway, long and short of it is, by the time we kind of came out of the quarantine in terms, I mean, we're still in it, obviously, you know, but the production world is back and the safety protocols are out there. And I think we're all out there doing our job safely. It was time to roll out the camera, and we used that camera recently for two spots we did for courts, and the spots are running right now. One is called Bike Ride and one is called Backyard Barbecue. And if you're watching sports on Sunday, you'll probably see the spots on TV if you're watching any football. Nice. And they look beautiful, and they just started running in the last 2 weeks. And as far as I'm concerned, they're just about as beautiful a spot as you're going. And the workflow was amazing, and we couldn't be happier with it. So that was a great investment in technology that I think the results are there. It's worth the money. It was worth the investment when you just see what comes out of the camera and then what mm-hmm. you can continue to do with it. Mm-hmm. We're never regret that investment.
Yeah. And one thing I'm curious about too, you know, and this is like at every level, you know, at every stage, whether you're director, cinematographer, audio engineer, editor, you know, there's something that could make your life a lot better. Mm-hmm. I know certainly with cinematographers too, they talk about glass, you know, investing in glass, mm-hmm. because that's one thing that, you know, technology won't change. And it's nice. Yeah. I will say it's really nice that there's, you know, Red and Alexa, and I'll even, you know, in a baby step, kind of lift Blackmagic into that category. But like you can get a camera that can work for 5 years, you know.
Yep.
It used to be that you mortgage your house and you get technology, you know, that lasts for 20, 30 years, but now technology changes so fast. But we're kind of at the point where the changes that Red will release aren't that drastic from 10 years ago when, you know, 2008, when Canon came out with their 5D Mark II, the first DSLR kind of cinema camera.
Yep.
But then occasionally you get like the Alexa Mini LF. It's like, hey, you want this, you know, $150,000 package? We're going to give it to you in a small form factor for half that cost, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a huge leap forward in technology. But yeah, glass, right? So that's one of those big ones that are, you know, new glass that's coming out is so crisp that mm-hmm. filmmakers want old glass or old looks, or you have to hand that off to a colorist and they gum it up. You know?
It seems counterintuitive to degrade an image, but when it gets too crisp, honestly, it feels off-putting to the eye. Mm-hmm. So right, but you know, I'll tell you, Ryan, you know you've been doing this a long time, and you hit the nail on the head, man. There's I would say, you know, outside of the tools, you know, that you know you got you've got your camera, you've got a, you know, qualified DP and head of camera that's running that stuff. The other things, you know, it's glass, you know, that lens is so important, but lighting, lenses and lighting, my God, you know, if you have those, you know, you got those, you're going to have something that looks like $1 million. You know, it's just, it all dovetails, you know, the lenses you're using, the cameras you're using, the lighting, you know, and a gaffer and a DP that can speak the same language.
Right.
And get, you know, it's all so important. And that's part of what I just love, watching all of those pieces come together and dovetail. You know, it's really rewarding. And I always see if you agree with this statement. I always say that one thing that makes me know I've done my job right is when I show up, like I'm mother hen, man, like until everybody is on set that first morning, I'm like cat on a hot tin roof. But once everybody's together, I should be the least useful person on set that day because I've done my job right. Everything has fallen in place. If I'm looking for stuff to do, I did my job right. So I think that's another thing is when I see a producer running around like a chicken with his head cut off on set, me included, clearly something's going wrong that day. If a producer is totally
chill, that's a good point.
It's all good.
Right. That's a really good point too. And I think certainly, you know, there's a different opportunities there in the sense of I've been on really big sets where there's a producer and they don't do much. And then there's a production manager and they're running around a lot.
Right,
and then
exactly.
There's an assistant to them and they're running around a lot.
Yeah.
But again, you know, our medium sized sets or even small sets, you're like, okay, I'm the executive producer. I'm also the production manager. But, you know, have you found like, is there something that is invaluable to you? For instance, like a production assistant that can just be for you day of or production manager. I mean, that's maybe the distinction that we sometimes make, like executive producer, production manager, because the production manager then is like, okay, all the things that I've coordinated today, I have to make sure that those things are happening. And then when things come up, they have to react, you know, and that's maybe a position that we utilize, you know, separate from an EP or producer.
We do. We have on our shoots, usually we'll have either, you know, that production manager or production coordinator role. And those lines blur. And sometimes I use those terms interchangeably. And that's an incredibly vital role to making sure. I mean, we're in the entertainment business. Our clients, you know, they don't do, our clients, your clients, you're not doing video production. They're not doing video production every day. So when they do it, they're excited about it. You know, they want to be entertained. Mm-hmm. They want that to be fun. You know, it should be, we don't want them to have a care in the world. They want to get there and they want to see a good looking craft service table and they want to know what's for lunch and, you know, and all those kind of things. And we just want to make sure that their every need is met. And I can't stress enough that comes down to that production coordinator, production manager, that role. That the impression that the client has, and not just the client, I mean, I consider like when talent come to the set, they're kind of clients too, because they can spread the word about, hey, those guys are great to work with, whatever. But anyone that walks through those doors needs to have a great experience. And I think that production coordinator, production manager role is real important to make sure that happens.
Mm-hmm. And how closely would you work with them, you know, kind of leading up to that? Is that something where, sorry if you're hearing, there are apparently dragons upstairs.
I can hear
dragging
it.
Across
and that's
the
cool.
Floor.
That's been kind of a fun part of you know, everything being on Zoom these days. You get a glimpse of people's home lives.
Yeah, welcome to my house I mean, actually, this is very surprising. You had asked before how many kids I have, and I was like, six. I have six kids. I'm surprised. My wife is playing zone defense, you know, with six different wide receivers.
I'm impressed.
Great job.
I'm very impressed. I've got two, and that was a good number for us.
Well, that's a funny question too. How do you do it? I'm like, how does somebody do one kid?
Yeah.
You know, like any amount of kids is going to take up all your time. So just get ready for that.
Yep.
Get ready to, you know, love more, but that's neither here nor there. Leading up and pre-producing and that type of thing, like with your production manager, coordinator, what's that look like? You know, do you set up a lot and hand it off, or are you able to kind of give them the parameters and let them run
with
it?
Yeah, you know, every job's a little bit different. I would say I'm really, really involved upfront, like, and probably they would tell you I'm too involved. I wish I was a little bit better at delegating, but I'm a bit of a control freak. So I'm really involved up front, and I get it down to we'll have one meeting where we kind of break down what the whole concept is and what the overall assignments are. Now, this is now on your radar. Shortly thereafter, we'll have another meeting where it's, here are the 12 things that are on your plate for this production leading up to it, and here's how I would prioritize them. Take those and run with it. And then there's maybe daily check-ins, like just updates. Oh, just so you know, these four things are done. I made these two calls. I'm waiting to hear back. Just kind of so I'm in the loop. And then maybe like leading up week before the shoot, we probably will have two or three like final pre-pro meetings where we really hammer it down and I can answer any final questions. The other thing is, it's like, hey, you know, we're in the last 3 days of pre-pro and I need some help. I can either pitch, jump in and help, or allocate some other resources to make sure it gets done. So it ebbs and flows. Very, very involved at the start. Let people do their job through the middle, and then kind of, you know, go through that checklist at the end just to make sure. Because it is being a control freak, but at the end of the day, you know, if we're on a set and something goes wrong, that buck does stop with me. I am the one.
Right.
I am the one that is going to have some explaining to do. So I think I'm fully within my right and to like say, okay, it may feel like I'm micromanaging, but that's kind of my job at this moment. So that's how I work. That, you know, I you know, and frankly, over time, I think people kind of earn that. They earn the right to have less check-ins from me.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. Like, I'm sure over time when you work with somebody, like you just said, with a director and a cinematographer, you get shorthand, but you gain trust and you have an understanding that, okay, I'm going to ask for this person to find the location, and I know I'm going to have a couple options tomorrow.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly. And and continuity is a big thing. You know, that shorthand of someone knowing what's going to make me happy. What am I looking for? If you know, you're exactly right. You know, I'm looking for a location. I'm not going to be pleased if you come back and show me one option. You know, someone that I've worked with for a long time is going to come back with, here are five options. I've ranked my top three. And oh, and by the way, here's another 12 just in case you don't like what you're seeing here, or I misinterpreted what you were looking for. You know, I think that's great. But that comes over time. You know, they anticipate what, because it doesn't, you know, it comes to me. And then once we call it down, then it goes to the client, or it goes to the agency creative director.
Exactly.
And then it goes to another client. So, I mean, there's layers way beyond me. And so I'm just like step one on that, you know, on that totem pole in terms of, you know, like it's got to get through me, and then it's got to get through here, and then it's got to get through here. So, someone that's worked with me for a long time is already anticipating, I don't just have to make Tom happy. I've got to make the next two rounds happy too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in that role, you're internal quality control. Mm-hmm. So they have to make sure that it at least passes that and be ready to pass agency and client quality control.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
I wonder too, during these unprecedented times, COVID, and you had mentioned you're working at home, you're about to go back, start working more into the office. Yeah. What's that balance been like for you? Right. Because, you know, as a business owner, but also as a producer of a project, like, you know, certain clients, I'll get calls in the evening or before I even sit down, you know, I'm laying in bed and you get some emails or something. What's that balance been like for you?
Yeah.
Has it been great? Has it been a struggle? Like, are you looking forward to getting out of the house? What's that been like?
There's so many ways to answer that question. So I'm going to try and I'll give you a bunch of them. It has not been a struggle. For one big reason was Robert Lasseter did a great job of getting us all set up to work from home. So we decided on a Monday that everybody's going to be working home starting on a Wednesday. And by that Friday, we all were up and working really smoothly. We work through a platform called Ring Central, which is it's basically a private, like a corporate Zoom account that you can have. So all of our phones, all of our video calls all go through Ring Central. Robert got us all set up with that. To be honest with you, I see my staff more on my computer screen than I did when we were all in person in the same building. We have constant check-ins. Oh, really? So that's been good. I've not gone stir crazy because we have our downtown office. We've got our studio. I'll be working in the downtown office 2 days a week. I'm in the studio constantly when we're shooting. And then we've also been on location with shoots. So I feel like I'm home half the time. I'm out of the home half the time. So it's really been easy for me to not like go stir crazy. And technology has allowed us to, I think we've learned some efficiencies in the way we work that are going to carry forward when we kind of get back to the way things were. I don't think it will be the way things were. I think there's going to be, I don't think I'm ever going to just have a phone call with my clients anymore. It's always going to be, hey, I'll send you a link and we're going to, and we're going to hop on and talk, because being able to read the body language, being able to quickly share a screen, it's a bit of a game changer that we weren't taking advantage of. So, I think there is a back half to that question, and I do want to address it and maybe discuss it with you, because I think you're going to have the same answer I do. The working from home is, I've actually found myself working more hours because I don't quite shut it off the way, like, you know, at work, hey, I left the office, you know, boom, my laptop's in my briefcase and I'm heading home. There was a dividing line. Now I just, you know, hey, it's 6:30. I'm going to run down. I'm going to have some dinner and then I'm going to come back up to the office and I'm going to fire up and just check on this one thing or look at this one thing. And then quite often I'll look at the clock and say, oh, it's 8:00. Geez, you know, I didn't spool down. I didn't walk away from it. So I find myself during the weekdays having less time off than, and that's on me. I mean, I have the ability to turn it off, but, but I find my, it's just too easy to keep working. And so I, you know, a goal for me is to find ways to shut it off a little bit. And I definitely find myself working on the weekends. But frankly, working on the weekends is something I've always done because it takes pressure off of a Monday morning for me. You know, if I have like, hey, you know, Mondays are days of meetings. So if I can get like three things checked off before I ever hit my desk Monday morning, I come in with like no stress, no nervousness. So, but working from home has been, I thought it was going to be a challenge and I thought productivity was going to tank. And it has not. I did. I thought productivity. Yeah. Well, from the production side of things, I was like, "How are we going to be able to do our jobs?" I was nervous. That nervousness lasted all of 2 weeks. So it's been a good thing. I mean, as good as it can be in these circumstances.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I have so many opinions on this, and it changes, you know, so much as well. You mentioned earlier as like a semi-empty nester. You know, I have six kids at home. So when I get home, I'm on until the kids go to bed. So I have some clients who will call and I will take their calls in that period. But then others that I know that are not pressing, I will not take until the next day. But that, you know, it's always a struggle. And I think since an executive producer is like an entrepreneur, is, you know, kind of in a same role of taking care of so many things at different times, like even like a business owner or entrepreneur, you got kind of got to be on more than just the 9-to-5. And I think too, I've seen, you know, oh my gosh, I forget his name, but a director friend from the area, he moved away. I knew him for like 6 months. He moved away, came back. He said there's like, you know, making donuts, you know, or we have the meal, you do work for the meal or work for the real. And I think the main point that I take from all of those analogies is the hunger for excellence, the hunger. And, you know, our slogan is like, let's make something awesome. Let's make awesome.
Yeah.
Everybody kind of has a twist on that. And sometimes that means working extra, but you have to find that balance. And it's different at different times in our life, I imagine. And you know, you have to figure it out with yourself or with your spouse or your family or whoever it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I 100% recognize that, my circumstances would be different if my two kids were still at home. You know, the fact that my daughter lives out in Denver and is in the working world and my son's, in his fourth year of college and is away from home. So my wife works from home right now. I'm working from home right now, but and we've got separate home offices and nice. I can be as productive. You know, I don't have those distractions. I can only imagine what it would be with six kids or even one kid at home. It would be, so in some ways it's good that, you know, it's like, if I do get a client call at night, I have, or a coworker call at night, you know, I'm here. Yeah. Let's work. It's been very, productive and beneficial for me. It's also been, it's a slippery slope where you're just like, hey, I'm not a brain surgeon yet. I feel like I'm on call 24/7.
And
it's on me to find, you know, it's on all of us to find that balance. But hey, going back, I liked what you had just said that you kind of, you know, you had, let's, what did you say? Make something great today or do something great today.
Yeah. I mean, striving for excellence, but for us, it's like, let's make awesome.
And I think that's, I love that. At our shop, we have a bunch of different ones, but the one that we kind of put into our presentations is good is the enemy of great. And that's kind of what we try to do is like, you know, good isn't good enough. You know, it's, you know, we want to do things that are great. We're proud of, they're great for the client, they're on target. Mm-hmm. So we all burn the hours that are necessary to do great work. And we take a lot of pride in that. And I think this is a good time for me to give a shout out to you guys, because one thing that's always impressed me about Backflip Films is you guys seem to have a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And what's always impressed me, it wasn't one of my favorite thing at the Wave Awards last year was the watermark of the music library.
So, yes, water flip.
Flip. It was so great. It was clever. It was funny. It was relatable. It was spot on. Anybody who's ever, you know, tried to get a piece of needle drop music was laughing their ass off about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that one stuck with me. And I appreciate the fact that you guys, you know, are always look like you're having fun. You're doing side projects. You're doing a podcast like this. I mean, you celebrate the industry. I've got guys on my team that are very much the same, that what they do in their free time is work on, you know, they're working on short films or they're writing or they're, you know, like some people, like might play in a softball league for recreation or a golf league. You know, a lot of people on our team are working on videos or music videos and things like that and their spare time. And it's great because they're bettering their craft and all that kind of stuff. So I always enjoy that. So I've enjoyed that about your team, that you guys seem to be doing what you love and it comes through. You know, when I see a piece like that at the Waves, I'm like, you know, how fun is that? You know, you guys could have taken a few nights off and gone home and watched some TV or whatever, but you guys did that instead and you made something that was great. So kudos to you guys. I thought that was fantastic.
Well, thank you. Yeah. And it's that idea of hunger, you know, and I think if you're going to be a successful filmmaker, you always have to be hungry. And for me, one of my hobbies is filmmaking, which is a little weird because that's my job as well, you know, the agency stuff. And I think that's the type of personality that, you know, I feel like it does great things in this realm. And I see, you know, like you guys in Kingdom doing great stuff. And I think you can just tell, like, yeah, no, those people love doing what they're doing. You know, and that's always encouraging too. You got to connect us. Like, I want to do creative stuff with your creative people. but it's been an interesting thing too. Like, as an entrepreneur, I'll also, you know, try to figure out, okay, how do we make this work and monetize it? And, you know, sometimes things can become this monster and then I don't start it, but I still do desire as a hobby to film make. And so I think another thing that I've done is like, I'm trying to learn Japanese.
Oh, nice.
It's not related to anything, you know, and it's something that I don't have to create a business for. Cause like, you know, I'm always talking to friends about, okay, what's a viable business that we could have? And, you know, spinning up, LLCs for films. And, you know, I'm always in that world. And even though it's a hobby of mine, I realize too that like sometimes you just need something separate. You know, you just need to take your brain, wash it out, rinse it, do something else, and then you're fresh for work or for that hobby.
Yep.
So I've kind of been doing that. And I know that was one of the things that we had for you too, is you mentioned some of the things you love, live music, sports. Yep. And we can clearly see the sports behind you.
Yeah.
Looks like you got some cards and you've got all the pendants. So I think you're representing quite well.
I'm pretty diehard in all the Wisconsin sports, you know, Badgers, Brewers, Packers, Bucks. One of my masks is a Wisconsin Badger mask. Yeah.
I haven't seen one like that. I love that.
So yeah, I'm really into it. You know, my brother and I growing up, we collected baseball cards. And, you know, when I was growing up, the Oakland A's and the Cincinnati Reds were kind of, in baseball were the teams. You know, you had the Big Red Machine with Joe Morgan and Pete Rose and Johnny Bench. And I've got a bunch of those cards up behind me. And, I've got a bunch of football cards as well. They're broken up across the whole room got a bunch of, from that time, it was Terry Bradshaw and Mean Joe Green and the Pittsburgh Steelers. So I've got all the bunch of steel curtain cards up there and a bunch of, you know, the Cowboys at that time or something else too. And so I've got a bunch of those, you know, just kind of, it's just kind of fun to, you know, instead of having them just sit in a box downstairs, I got a bunch of them up there and I'm like, God, I got a lot of Hall of Famers up here. Yeah. It's pretty cool.
I love that so much too. Cause you say a box downstairs. That's what I have. I have a box, you know, back behind that wall with, I think we found all my baseball cards, my basketball cards.
Yeah.
You know, and at some point my wife's like, let's get rid of them. And I'm like, no, it's a fun collection and it's maybe worth money at some point. And I don't know.
I'm surprised how much, enjoyment when I pulled them out and did this, how much enjoyment I got, you know, going, you know, and how much I drove my wife crazy where I was telling stories about,
different time. Yeah.
It was, you know, and, you know, like I've got a Joe Morgan card up there and he just, passed away this week. Mm. And that was kind of sad for me. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it just so good memories, but yeah, I mean, sports are a big thing for me, big time live music, you know, in the time of quarantine, I think that the thing that's been the hardest on me is not being able to go and enjoy live music. And I'm talking in any setting. It can be a concert, it can be a club, you know, it can be a concert in somebody's home, or a backyard concert. I don't care. I miss mm-hmm. it. And, if I can just keep going down that road a little bit, I saw the last concert at the Sylvie before they had to shut themselves down for COVID. But my wife and I went down to see Wilco, and we at the time, you know, so this is March. We literally were debating whether we were going to go down that night. We, you know, we were just like, are they going to cancel it? Are they not? Should we go? And if you turn the clock back those 7 months. Mm-hmm. You know, none of us knew what was going on. None of us knew how serious this was or, you know, what was going on. Well, anyway, we did. We ended up going to that concert. It was kind of weird that weekend. On Friday night, we went to the comedy club and we saw Jay Farrow comedy on stage.
Yeah.
Hell, he was great. Awesome. Boy, does he work blue. I think he was more blue than Red Fox or Eddie Murphy. I couldn't believe it, but it was a good show. And then we went to, we had our company Festivus party at Rare on Saturday night, you know, so about, you know, 80 people, you know, employees and significant others. And then on Monday night, we went to the Sylvie for a sold out show to see Wilco. Mm. And 2 days later, the world shut down where, right. you know, where we all were 2 days later, we were all working from home. And it was, mm-hmm. it was, I remember, you know, we were scared, you know, we didn't know what to think. And it was like, holy shit, this just got real. And we were like, we probably shouldn't have been standing in a crowd of 2,000 people. But at the end of the day, it was one of the best concerts I'd ever been at. And, you know, I've seen Wilco about a dozen times and they never disappoint. But I think at this point though, I have to give, well, it's not a public service announcement, but it is it's free advertisement for the Sylvie. You know, Frank Productions, they built the Sylvie. That is a world-class music venue. You go in there and you would think you're in, you know, Brooklyn or LA or Minneapolis. I mean, or Austin, that is as good a music venue as you're going to find.
Oh, wow.
And they're bringing in great music every night. And, you know, it can hold comfortably 2,000 people. I mean, it's big time, and it's built for one thing and one thing only, and that's live music. So it sounds great. You got, no matter where you are, great. You feel like you're on top of the stage, and it's Madison is really lucky to have it. And I hope that at the end of quarantine that and I'm sure they will, that they're going to open right back up. When I see businesses closing, I hope and pray the Sylvie is not one of them, because that is a gem. So
yeah.
Anyway,
well, and
but yeah, I had tickets for three other shows and that got canceled because of COVID. So I'm hoping those bands decide to make their way back.
Yeah. Well, and that's such a, I mean, hopefully that's a sweet memory, you know, in your mind that, yeah, we got to do this thing because even after quarantine, you know, are they going to have groups be separated by a seat, even if it's only 3 feet away? Like, you know, has the world changed in that regard? And was that the last time you could be shoulder to shoulder with somebody you didn't know for the, you know, foreseeable future?
Yeah. That's what I love about live music. You know, you're sharing, you got all these people you don't know, but you're all sharing a common experience and you're into it. And it's a magic moment that's, you know, you can't play it again later. I mean, sort of you can, but I mean, in that moment, if you're invested in that moment and your cell phone's in your pocket, you're just, you know, and you're just into the music, you know, those moments are priceless. And, you know, those are things, man, no matter how stressed out I am about the day or what's coming up, you know, what she's saying, live music transports me into another place. You know, my brother is 5 years older than me, and, you know, he was a big music guy. He's a good musician. And, you know, while people in my high school were listening to, you know, a lot of, you know, what was pop music at that time, my brother would have none of it. And he was forcing me to listen to Eric Clapton, you know, to his credit. I mean, it was like, you are going to listen to this. You are not going to listen to that. It was so, if anything like Duran Duran were to hit my turntable, it was immediately taken off. And, you know, I'm now listening to Zeppelin, or I'm listening to Cream. And, and I thank him for that. And we would go to Summerfest. We'd drive up from Rockford to, we get a group of friends and we go to Summerfest every year. And I was the little brother that was lucky enough to tag along. And, nice. I cherish that. And that's where I got my love of live music, is going up to Summerfest. I mean, I remember, before the Marcus Amphitheater was built, they had the rock and roll stage, which was basically just these wood benches that went back 150 rows and horrible sight lines. Everything was flat. And I remember though, you know, getting there and speaking of Eric Clapton, my brother was like, Clapton's headlining the rock stage, and that's what we're going to do. And so we went in there and we camped out all day, sat through all the shows until the Blasters from California opened up for Eric Clapton. And it was one of the greatest, greatest live music nights you could ever imagine.
Oh, that's awesome.
So it was really, so live music for me is not, it's more than a hobby. It's more, I mean, it's kind of a way of life. And I'm not a musician. I'm not musical in any way. You know, my father was actually in the Kenosha Symphony when he grew up. My daughter is very, very musical. My brother is musical. The gene totally skipped me and my sister. We didn't get any of it. It frustrates the shit out of me. So my contribution to the music scene is making sure that I go and support live music and support the artists. And,
yeah, keep funding them.
I love it. Yeah.
That's awesome. How long did your dad play in the Kenosha Symphony? I went to high school in Kenosha. So my sister,
did you? Nice. Okay.
My sister was in the symphony for a few years, I think.
Yeah. So my dad unfortunately passed away about 21 years ago. But he grew up in Kenosha. You know, his family, they all worked at AMC, and he went to school at UW-Milwaukee, and then after that he lived and worked in Kenosha until he moved to Illinois. And so for those probably 5 years when he was back in Kenosha, he was in the symphony, and he played bassoon.
That's awesome.
And kind of one of the things was a real disappointment for me. So my daughter, who's 25 now, when she was four, when he died, when she was four, she is so musical and so like my dad in so many ways. I wish that, you were an a cappella at UW-Madison, and, as
true,
with my daughter. And, my dad would have loved all that. My daughter actually is in the, out in Denver. She's in the choir for the Colorado Symphony. So she's continued that. My dad would, that would be a wish,
awesome.
You know, for me, if my dad were living, would be to go to Colorado with him and catch the symphony performing at Red Rocks. That would be, if I were to able to get one day, what would I wish for? I think that'd be it.
Oh, that sounds amazing too. Just be like, Dad, it skipped generation, but here it is.
I know.
So proud.
Yeah, my dad bought me a drum set. My brother plays guitar. My dad brought me a drum set, thinking we were going to have a little band in the family. And I could not keep
it
a
beat. It just didn't work.
And my dad was so frustrated. It's like, I don't get what you don't get about this. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, and it was just, I couldn't do it. And it was, no one was more disappointed than me, because I was sure I was going to be a great drummer, but mm-hmm. it was not to be.
Family band. I would love to have a family band, especially with six. let's see. We do have Matt Martindale says, hi, Tom.
Hey, Matt Martindale.
Hopefully he's still on, or maybe he'll come back.
I'll give a shout out to Matt Martindale. Matt Martindale is a good motion graphics guy. If anybody out there that's in the industry, Matt Martindale, give him a call. He does some web design. He does motion graphics. He's a freelancer that you might want to get in your Rolodex. Not that there's really Rolodexes anymore, but Matt Martindale, he's a good egg, man. Give old Red a shout.
Perfect. I'll definitely write that down. And one of our viewers, who's also a friend of mine, Carolyn, dang yes, good is the enemy of the great.
Yeah.
Striving for excellence, reaching for something awesome, makes things more fun, way more effective. You had mentioned that too, like our clients, and this is one of the things we strive for, like you guys, like our clients always say some of my best or favorite times are when we can be on set with you guys, mm-hmm. and that kind of warms the heart. And it's like when we're working our hardest, but we're taking care, mm-hmm. and sharing, in that friendly, in that congenial way, we're sharing that love, like, people feel that. So Carolyn also did have a question. What is your most memorable sports moment you've experienced, unrelated to the topic, but fun? So this could be your experience as a, I don't know, were you an athlete? Did you play sports?
I played a ton of sports. God did not bless me with great athletic ability. He gave me just enough to be competitive and get out there and not get laughed at. But I was never the first guy picked. I'll be honest with that.
Awesome.
But no, I grew up playing baseball, tennis, and basketball. Those were kind of my three sports. I tried football for one season and realized that I really hate getting hit. And so I quickly gave that up. But baseball for me by far is my favorite sport. That's a real passion for me. But mm-hmm. I actually do have a favorite sports moment, and it was a great question. But so that first job I mentioned out of college. So the owner of that company, bringing up Tony Marsili again, was a season ticket holder for the Cubs. And my first year working there, the Cubs were hosting the All-Star game. Wrigley Field was hosting the All-Star game. And Tony couldn't go to the game, and I was like one of only two people in the agency that was single and could pretty much do anything I wanted at any moment. You know, sure. I was like, hey, are you free tonight? Hell yeah. So he's like, hey, I can't go to the All-Star game. So he comes to my office like at 3:30 and goes, hey, I can't go to the All-Star game tonight. Here's two tickets. You should leave now. I was like, oh, I love you. This is great. So I grabbed the one other single guy that worked there that I knew would be free and said, hey, Tim, let's go. So we hopped on the train, went downtown, and we're sitting. His tickets were 30 rows behind home plate. And I'm sitting here and I'm looking around as the seats are filling up. I've got Raleigh Fingers one seat behind me. I've got Steve Garvey one seat in front of me. And the entire section is just peppered with Hall of Famers. And I'm just like beside myself. Gosh. And then all of a sudden comes in, sits down right next to me is Marge Schott, who is the owner of the Cincinnati Reds, you know, famous racist and all that, you know, kind of stuff. And I got to sit and watch an entire game and listen to Marge Schott just being so politically incorrect.
Oh no.
So sitting next, it's like sitting next to your completely racist grandfather watching a baseball game. And it was uncomfortable and magical all at the same time where I was like, oh my God, no one's going to believe this.
Oh
but, but getting to turn around and to tell Raleigh Fingers what a hero. Hank Aaron was there. It was just man, but to turn around and just to say something to Raleigh Fingers and then to have him say, hey, that's great. But, you know, I'm here with my family. Can you just kind of leave me alone?
No.
No, he was totally cool about it.
Okay.
And I appreciated his honesty,
sure?
But he set the ground. I thought he was like one of the classiest ground rule setters of all times. It was like, hey man, I appreciate you being a fan, but I'm here with my family tonight. So let's not do this every inning. I don't need to talk baseball with you.
Yeah.
You know, and he was cool. He patted me on the back at one point in the game, but it was nice. Really funny. And I thought, you know, good for you, Raleigh, for setting the ground rules in not a dickish way at all.
That's
but
awesome.
It was a great baseball moment. I was just, but of course, pre-cell phone, I have no photo evidence. I don't have selfies with me and Steve Garvey or any of that kind of stuff. But it was I'll never forget it. It was great.
Yeah, I mean, that probably makes it a better memory, though, because it's just a memory. You weren't spending time on your phone. You weren't, you know, dicking around, trying to take photos.
And at the time, I mean, Wrigley had just put lights in. So that nighttime baseball was brand new at Wrigley. So them hosting the All-Star game was contingent upon them putting lights in. And so they got the lights in, and it was a game changer. And it, you know, sitting under the lights at Wrigley, I'm a Brewer fan. I mean, don't get me wrong. You know, I am all Brew Crew, but something about sitting there at Wrigley under the lights behind home plate with all these dignitaries, that was a Field of Dreams moment for me, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. So we are kind of getting to the end of our time here. I love this. Like I totally get why Joe Rogan just talks to people for 4 hours. I can't do that. And I want to respect your time.
Yeah.
But I did one other thought, and then I'm going to ask you. So while I'm talking, you can think about two truths and a lie. This is how we get to know each other better.
Okay.
So tell me two true things about yourself and one lie, and me and the people at home will try to guess what that lie is. But you had said your dad grew up in Kenosha. Did they move? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Rockford, Illinois. Yeah. My dad was an engineer in the aviation industry, and there's a company down in Rockford called Sunstrand Aviation. And, he worked there. So we grew up in Rockford, because that's where my dad's career was at.
Okay.
And then he worked there, basically his whole career. You know, that was the thing. That was you worked at, you know, my grandfather was, worked at for United Auto Workers. He was a UAW Local 803 for his whole career. My dad was at Sunstrand Aviation for his whole career. That was the generational thing. That's why we grew up in Rockford.
Mm-hmm. So I'll give you a minute to think about that. I'll talk about, our upcoming guests. So we've actually got Emily here at Backflip. She's a developer here, but she's such an organized person and a go-getter. She's also helping reach out to produce this show to schedule more folk. So she's actually reaching out to people that, you know, Shane Hurlbut and Lydia Hurlbut, cinematographer, and Lydia runs the Hurlbut Academy. So just really great, interesting people we want to talk to. We're working on getting them on the show. But then all the other people in town that we know. So I think in 2 weeks, we actually have Ashley Taylor, who I believe right now she's the president of the AAF, American Advertising Federation, mm-hmm. here in Madison. So we're going to have her on and talk about a lot of fun things. You can also check out previous episodes. They're all on here. Tom, you had asked me how many people watch this. And, you know, we get between 10 and, you know, 60 or so live. But then after the fact, it's hundreds to thousands, which is really cool with the internet. You know, we can get this up, we get it scheduled, and then we add just a little bit of marketing behind it, and people tune in and, you know, watch the stuff. And that's mm-hmm. that's been a fun learning process as we're at, you know, episode 30 or something here, to see, you know, live. Live is so much fun because people jump in and comment and we get friends to say hi and all that. But then after the fact, there's huge value as well. So I do want to thank you for coming on and just sharing just a hint of the depth of Tom Kermgard with mm-hmm. us and our friends here.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it. And, you know, one thing I did want to mention before we do Two Truths and a Lie, I can't believe we didn't work this into our conversation, but I have been able to binge a lot of shows during the time of
oh my gosh,
of COVID, and yes. I've got a top six, but I gotta give the one that surprised me the most, and I'm gonna make it a recommendation.
Real quick before you give us this, yep. can you I want to have a perspective of your mind. Like, mm-hmm. what is, and you can take this however you want, what is your favorite movie?
My favorite movie would probably be Field of Dreams.
Awesome. Okay. That helps give us a little bit of perspective.
Yeah. I would, that has everything in it for me. So, mm-hmm. I've got a big top, you know, but I also, you know, like I love Tarantino movies, and I thought I predicted Parasite would win Best Picture last year because I thought mm-hmm. it was the best picture mm-hmm. that I'd seen in 10 years. So I'm all over the map. But yeah. So the one show, and this one surprised me, I resisted it, but I was driving out to Denver to see my daughter, and I was listening to the Spectrum on Sirius XM, and one of the DJs started raving about the show Umbrella Academy. And I had no desire to see it. I'm not a big superhero movie guy. But I decided that my wife and I decided to watch it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably one of the best shows I've seen in a long time. I mean, I put it up there with different genres, but I would put it up there with Mad Men, with Breaking Bad, nice. With Ozark. The production values, great. But the one reason, even if you don't like superhero movies, watch it. Because of the soundtrack, the music in it, whoever is in charge of the music killed it. And I cannot recommend it strongly enough. Really fun, great character development. And I am jonesing for season 3. So I don't know when that's going to be.
Yeah, I was going to ask, is it season 1 and season 2? It stays there?
Season 1 and season 2. Season 2 is better than season 1, hands down.
Nice.
Season 2 becomes like more of a period piece as they go back in time.
Right.
But season 2 ends beautifully, setting up season 3. I cannot wait. So if you get a chance, check out Umbrella Academy. It surprised me and blew me away.
Yeah.
So there you go.
We've watched that, and Carolyn Averill also says, wait, even season 2? Because she thought number 1 was really awesome.
Oh, I love season 2. You know, part of it for me, I don't want to give anything away, but, you know, when they go back to the 60s, I just love that time period. And I thought the sets, the costumes, I mean, it was eye candy. It was just eye candy. They're in, again, not giving any of the plot away, but they are in Dallas in the 60s in the weeks leading up to the Kennedy assassination. So that kind of puts it into perspective. So I thought it was great.
Fantastic.
Really, I thought the character development in season 2 was a lot of fun.
And Carolyn also says the Oshkosh cameo cracked her up.
Yes. Yeah. I was a big fan of that.
Is that season two?
That was in season two.
Okay. Yeah. We've watched season one. We haven't caught up to season two because we've watched some other shows. So, so let's see. That's your number one recommendation right now is Umbrella Academy.
Yeah.
Did you have, like, what are your couple other picks?
Well, Ozark, I think Ozark is just brilliant. Mm-hmm. Jason Bateman is definitely one of my favorite actors. He's so good in everything. Silicon Valley. I never watched it. Jack Whaley at The Office had been recommending it. So I binged it, loved it. Barry on HBO is really fun. Dark, but
Barry's
fun.
So good. Yeah.
It's really fun to watch Henry Winkler in a kind of a dark role. That was really fun.
Yes.
Went back and rewatched Fargo, the first three seasons to kind of get tuned up for season four. And God, that's good. I forgot how good that was.
Yeah.
Who's in season four?
Like Chris Rock?
Chris Rock.
Yeah.
Jason Schwartzman. It's really fun. It's rival mafias in Kansas City going for it. Hey, how are you? Hi.
There we go. My mic's back on. That's Magdalene. Come here. Say hi.
Hey.
Since you walked over here. Say hi, Magdalene.
Hi.
Good to see you.
This is Mr. Kerngard. He's a friend of mine.
Good to see you.
He says, nice to see you.
Thanks for joining us. I'm big into the guilty pleasures. I like to... I'll sometimes watch like just an episode of a sitcom right before bed because it relaxes me. And so
yes, 100%.
My guilty pleasure sitcoms are Superstore, rewatching 30 Rock. And then this is, I'm embarrassed to say this one, but I really liked it. It was the show called The Unicorn, just because I think Walter Goggins is a great actor. He was on Justified. He was,
is this the sci-fi show?
No, this is one. So the Unicorn is Walter Goggins is a guy. I'm guessing he's supposed to be mid 40s, whose wife dies of cancer. Now he's left alone to raise his two daughters, and he's called a unicorn because he's bait for all the single women that are out there because he's unattached and emotionally vulnerable. And so he's the unicorn. All the women want him, and he's trying to figure out how to get on with his life and raise his daughters and not feel guilty about the fact that he wants to continue living. It's pretty well done. It's a little corny at times, but Walton Goggins is an incredible actor that I was glad to see. He's a character actor, but I was really glad to see him get a starring role. He is supremely talented.
Yeah, he got something that he could lead, you know, because he's always a secondary character and antagonist.
Yep, supremely talented. And
that's awesome.
And rumor has it, I mean, he is supposed to be that one of those guys in Hollywood that is like everybody's best friend. Everybody loves him. He's just supposed to be like a great guy. So I saw an interview with Timothy Oliphant one time talking about Walton Goggins, and it kind of just stuck with me. So
that's awesome.
Anyway,
have you seen The OA? That's like
that
The OA and The Morning Show on Apple TV. So
The Morning Show was spectacular.
Wasn't that like, you know, it's the first show that's been like, all right, sexual, you know, accusation
well
and like people doing bad stuff. But then like actually hearing Steve Carell, you know, his side of the story, and was it Martin Short, you know?
Oh my God.
Just like the worst human being in that show as well.
Yeah. And then, and Steve Carell actually saying, you know, basically then at that point, just distancing himself from Martin Short. Yeah. It was a great moment.
Yeah. And Steve Carell's like, why is it bad what I did? So to see him struggle with that.
Yep.
And you know, on the other side, Jennifer Aniston being fantastic.
Yep.
And Reese Witherspoon, like they are just, their dynamic is amazing.
Billy Crudup was
so amazing.
Billy Crudup stole the show for me though. He had so much fun in that role. I mean, every scene he is smiling in every scene and sarcastic and devious, and he's a great actor.
Yes. Yes, he was great. So if you haven't seen The OA, you should watch that. It's a little trippy.
I wrote it down, man.
Yeah. It's a little trippy, but it's so much fun. It's got Britt Marling, She writes, produces, stars in it, which sometimes speaks badly of something, but in this case, it's amazing. You've got Jason Isaacs in it, and then Phyllis Smith from The Office. You recognize her. She's amazing. She plays like this woman who's just so unsure of herself and awkward and, you know, just a lovely person, but like it's amazing acting.
You know that Phyllis used to be, in her younger years, was a cheerleader for the Los Angeles Rams.
Oh, was she really?
Yeah. Or they might have been St. Louis Rams at the time, but she that's on her bio that she was a cheerleader for the Rams.
That's awesome.
So, all right. Hey, should we do cool. two truths and a lie?
Let's do it. Yeah.
I think all right.
enough.
So I'll give you three things here.
Yep.
I played catch with a football with Chad Johnson, Chad Ochocinco of the Cincinnati Bengals.
Yeah.
I shared the stage during a concert with Rick Nielsen and Cheap Trick.
Nice.
I got to do the product placements in the original Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie from New Line Cinema. Two truths and a lie.
Yeah. Hopefully not in that order.
No, they were mixed up. I did the shell game.
Let's see. So number two is you were on stage with Cheap Trick. And did you play? No, you didn't play because you don't play. So you somehow got on stage.
I worded it as I got to share the stage with the stage. Rick Nielsen and Cheap Trick.
Nice. And number one is throwing a football with Ochocinco?
Playing catch with with Chad Ochocinco. Yep.
And then the third one is you did the original product placement for?
I did the product placement for the original Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie from New Line Cinema.
What does that entail, the product placement for that?
Product placement would be taking a script, dissecting a script, and saying, oh, they're calling for the turtles to be eating pizza in this scene. I think that should be Domino's.
Perfect. Okay.
They're eating chips in this scene. I think that should be something with, and then working with a company to actually negotiate those contracts to get those in the movie.
You did mention earlier in the show that you got to work on big brands, and I forget specifically, you mentioned Ninja Turtles, but I forget specifically how you worked with them. So that, I want that one to be true. I really do, because I love the Ninja Turtles movie. That's another one. The Toys That Made Us. There's Ninja Turtle action figures, movies. There's a documentary on that that's fantastic on Netflix. So I want that to be true. I want you to have done the product placement Ninja Turtles, because then I can be like, next time I'm talking to my friends about Ninja Turtles, which you know is all the time. It could be like, you know, my friend Tom, he did the product placement in that first film. Number two, Cheap Trick, and number one, Ochocinco. Those are really good. You know, being in production, you get to be, you know, around and interact with people. So like, I feel like that Ochocinco could be true. The Cheap Trick, you were on stage. Carolyn says Cheap Trick has to be true. She wants it so badly. Carolyn says number one is a lie, playing football or toss with Ochocinco. Yeah, I want number three to be true. Cheap Trick. I'm going to say number two is a lie. Maybe it was a different band. That'd be a good lie. You know, you just switched the band name.
Yeah. So, all right. Is that your guess?
That's my guess. Number two.
You are correct. Nice. So here's the deal. So I know Rick Nielsen, and I know three of the four members of Cheap Trick, because they're from Rockford, Illinois, so they're hometown heroes.
Oh,
and nice. I actually, for a time period, worked with Rick Nielsen's wife. She was actually a prop stylist at Steve Pitkin Photo Studios down in Rockford. And Rick would often drop by, a very, very nice, generous human being, and would bring lunch to people. In the middle of winter, Rick Nielsen would drive down in his vehicle, start his wife's car so that it would be warm when she left so that she didn't have to get into a cold car.
That's awesome.
So cool. also in this studio, they had a Coca-Cola machine, and it was Coke, Diet Coke, Sprite, Diet Sprite. And then the last one just had Rick Nielsen's face on it. And if you put your money in and hit that one, a beer would come out, and the beer would change based what it was. I never did get to up on stage with Cheap Trick. There was a chance that I was going to get to at the Rockford Metro Center, and it fell through. So I always am bummed out about that. I tried to get a media credentials and a camera and all kind of bullshit, and it didn't work out. But yes, I did play catch with Ocho Cinco. We had him in. We did a GoDaddy.com shoot, and he was a spokesperson. I did a shoot with him. The reason I brought this one up is for self-deprecation, because the thing that sucks, when I mentioned earlier that I like sports and I'm a marginal at best athlete, I got to play catch with Ocho Cinco, and during a scene, he's actually kind of catching a ball above his head, you know, and I had to like hit the same spot. And so Ocho Cinco was like, well, let's practice a little bit. So we were over practicing.
Nice.
And we played for about 20 minutes. And then at one point he goes to run, and I go to run, like I'm scrambling out of the pocket, and I trip, my toe caught a leg of a C stand, and I went sprawling over the turf at Middleton High School. I went down very, like my body was moving in sections. It wasn't like a graceful fall. So, you know, my 20 minutes of playing catch with Ocho Cinco will always be remembered by my clumsiness. It is true.
That's awesome.
And I did get to do the product placement, at least in part, for the original Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle movie that had Judith Hogue, and I forget who the actor was that was in it. Long and short of it, it was a great experience. When I talked to you, Ryan, about not understanding what great opportunities I had in my first job out of college. Yeah. That was one of them. You know, the owner came in and slapped a script on my desk. He had a side business, which was licensed products. And he was one of two people that had exclusive licensing rights to the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And he was putting them on all of the products that his ad agency worked on. So you saw tie-ins with Banquet meat pies and brown berry bread and Thomas English muffins and boom, boom, boom. Anyway, they reached out to him, New Line Cinema, which was a new studio at that time. And this was like their first big release, reached out and said, which of your companies that you represent do you think we could get into this movie? So he gave me the script and said,
nice.
Dial it up, get it done. And so I got to go through that, and it was really, so I got to do it for that and a really forgettable Christian Slater movie. So forgettable, I don't remember the name of it, but it involved Christian Slater and skateboards, and doesn't matter. But it was really a fun experience. Again, it just goes back to my original point of having all these great work experiences, and sometimes you can't see the forest for the trees. And I was so young and cocky that I didn't realize the great opportunity I was given at a young age. And I feel the need to give Tony a lot of credit. So we're Facebook friends. If there was a chance he was listening out there, he's retired now, lives out where it's warm. But if you were listening, I hope he knows how much I appreciate everything you did for me coming out of college. So there you go.
That's awesome. Yeah, and it looks like, who do we got? Sam Rockwell was a head thug in Ninja Turtles. Kevin Eastman.
Nice. Hey, who was the main actor? The main, not one of the turtles, but like the male lead.
There was Casey Jones, right? So he was a human. Elias.
Yes, and that guy was destined to be an A-lister, and he did a bunch of movies like at that time, and then was never to be heard from again. But I thought he was good. I thought he was a good actor. Maybe a bit too much of a character actor to be the lead man, but he was really, I thought he was good. That movie, I'm not embarrassed at all to say I was involved in that movie.
I was the right age for that too. And I loved that. And then number two, The Secret of the Ooze. I had all the action figures. That's the age I was.
There you go.
We do have, so Paul Zwicker.
The Zwick!
says or wants to ask what your favorite band is. And
oh man, thanks, Paul Zwicker. Paul Zwicker and I work together. Paul's a great shooter and just a nice human being. And Paul, my favorite band would be Wilco. My favorite individual artist would be Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah, thank you, Tom, for coming on. And like I said, in 2 weeks we'll have Ashley Taylor on. Next week we'll get somebody in there as well. We'll let you know on Monday who we have. Thank you for tuning in. Yeah, that's all we got. That's all we got for today. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for watching. Bye.